Final matter is Rosen versus Superintendent Mahoney. Mr. Schwartz, you've tried, I don't know how many cases in front of me back in my other life, but I was, when I saw your name, I don't think you've ever argued in front of me in this court, have you?
No, sir. No, sir. It is a bit of deja vu.
Hopefully you do better with your arguments than you did with your trials. Man.
I was expecting that.
Golly, Ned. Hit the guy before he starts.
Why is it part of the fundraiser?
May it please the court. Carl Schwartz, along with John Chosky, with the firm of Wiseman and Schwartz. For the appellant, Adam Rosen, I would ask for 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Let me ask this then. Obviously, we've got EDPA to deal with here.
Yes.
And what is the Supreme Court case or cases that you're relying upon for establishing the rule that would allow us to overturn the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's case on the issue?
It's the rule of it's the rule of Buchanan that this court, with your honor sitting on as one of the panel members and in an opinion authored by Judge Chertoff in 2004.
But that's not a Supreme Court case.
Well, except the Buchanan is the Supreme Court case. And this court aptly applied the Supreme, that case aptly applied the rule of Buchanan that holds that although a defendant who puts forward a mental illness defense and calls an expert who has evaluated him, although he waives his right to assert his Fifth Amendment privilege to remain silent, to not be a witness against himself, and must submit to an interview with a Commonwealth or government expert, the stuff of that interview is limited to rebuttal of the psychiatric defense. And I will tell the court that your application of the rule of Buchanan was not explicitly, but certainly endorsed by the United States Supreme Court 9 years later in the case of Kansas versus Cheever, where the court referred to the rule of Buchanan in language that was remarkably resonant of the Gibbs opinion, and said that that interview or that the information disclosed by the defendant is limited only, using the terms only, to rebuttal, and describe that as the rule of Buchanan, a case that predated the motion that was filed in this case. And by the trial court's failure to apply that rule, what happened here is a defendant in an admittedly troubling case was precluded from testifying in his own defense in a case where there were no other live eyewitnesses, in a case where the fact finder determined that at the start of this incident with his wife, he did not think about killing his wife. He did not premeditate. And accepted the possibility, if not likelihood, that the wife instigated the physical confrontation. In a case where the medical examiner, Dr. Hood, who I know your honor is familiar with, testified.
Everybody in this case.
What's that?
Familiar with everybody in this case.
Right, right. Where Dr. Hood testified that you can't really tell the story from the injuries other than that it was a frenzied incident. You would need other evidence to tell the story. Yet the trial court, the fact finder, found first degree, as he said, based explicitly and wholly on the injuries. So what could have been more important in a case like this, where a man, you know, who is on trial for his life, who has acknowledged the homicide, who has acknowledged essentially that he must pay for the homicide, merely sought his right to testify to convince 12 jurors that he never intended to kill his wife. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Your Honors, identified the correct rule. They talked about limited waiver in their opinion. Yet they misapplied it in a very gross and obvious way. First of all, they recognized Gibbs, but held that they were not bound by Gibbs. Yet they, and Gibbs is this court's holding under remarkably similar facts. In Gibbs, it involved a compelled evaluation by a Dr. Sadoff, then a second trial where the mental illness defense that had been raised initially was no longer raised, yet the Commonwealth was permitted to use that evaluation, and this court held the rule of Buchanan precluded its use.
Can I just, I mean, isn't part of the question whether Buchanan is, you know, if it's a limit or if it's an example of, I mean, I'm reading this one part of Buchanan that says, if a defendant requests such an evaluation or presents psychiatric evidence, then at the very least, the prosecution may rebut this presentation with evidence from the reports of the examination that the defendant requested. That maybe if that's it, at the very most, then the rule of Buchanan works for you. But right now, as I read Buchanan, it says at the very least. And so when it says at the very least, and you need to show a clearly established Supreme Court law, and this one is setting the low the low bar, not the high bar, how does that help you if you need to set the high bar?
I have a couple of responses to that. First, determining that what I am suggesting is the rule of Buchanan, which is not my suggestion. It was this court's suggestion.
But we still...
I'm with you on that. But what I'm saying is initially, as an initial matter, it would require, which this court should not do, overruling Gibbs. Because this court found that Buchanan was a clearly established Supreme Court law. And I will say this. The Buchanan case creates the construct wherein this type of evidence that's compelled, that traditionally would have been seen as taken in violation of the Fifth Amendment, but there's a carve out. The animating rationale being that we need to hear the defendant's statements for whatever diagnoses or expert opinions that the defendant's expert may make so that we can contradict it. So what the Buchanan court said was, here is the construct wherein this type of evidence may be compelled. And the answer to your question as to what was the correct interpretation and application, not extension, was provided by the United States Supreme Court in 2013 in Cheever, because the Cheever court used the term, as this court did, only. The court said that it is limited only to this rebuttal purpose. And that's what makes Buchanan, I would say, in passing.
So it's kind of Buchanan plus Cheever.
Well, no, it's not plus Cheever, because what Cheever said was, this is the rule of Buchanan. If this is the rule of Buchanan.
But in Cheever, the mental status was raised in both trials, correct?
Yes, sir, it was.
So, I mean, to me, that really comes down to, is a waiver of mental status defense in the first trial, does it carry over to the second trial when that defense is not put into play by the defendant, correct?
Correct.
And it looks as if certain cases like Gibbs talk about cases in chief, but But I don't know of any particular case that talks necessarily that says for purposes of impeachment, if this person were to have gotten on the stand, that you can't bring it in.
Right, and I can address that. So let me say at the outset that this impeachment discussion is often preceded with a citation to Harris versus New York, a case in which, I mean, I want to identify all the hidden goblins in, against my argument, a case in which the United States Supreme Court held that statements taken in violation of Miranda, while they can't be used in the case in chief, they can be used to impeach. And as we said in our briefing, let me step back and say there's no talismanic significance to impeachment evidence. As this court knows, it has seen many cases come through the courts in Pennsylvania. Impeachment evidence is often more powerful and more devastating to a defense than is direct evidence, especially in regard to case law such as Lively and Brady that talks about that kind of evidence being usable substantively. The distinction between the distinction is not so much between impeachment and substantive evidence as it is between compulsion and non-compulsion. Harris, cases like Harris, are cases in which there's no issue as to whether the statement was compelled. So there's no issue around the traditional basis of the Fifth Amendment. Were you compelled to be a witness against yourself? The voluntariness wasn't raised in that case. Contrast a case like Harris with another case that we cited in our brief, New Jersey versus Portash, which is an impeachment case. But the court found, and this is a United States Supreme Court case, and it's clearly established Supreme Court law, clearly established before this trial court ruling. And the court found no significance in terms of admissibility to the fact that it was impeachment evidence. The significance was, is it compelled or is it not compelled? And the court made the determination that it was compelled because there was a coercive sanction. There, the coercive sanction was a contempt citation for failing to testify before the grand jury. You'll recall that Portash was a case where immunized grand jury testimony was a court was asked by the government to allow that immunized testimony to come in, not in the case in chief, but like Harris, and they argued Harris, to impeach. And the court said, no, it's not about impeachment. I mean, I'm not saying they use these words, but this is, it's not about impeachment versus substance and evidence. One can be just as powerful as the other. It's about which, you know, traditionally violates the core concern of the Fifth Amendment. And because there was a coercive sanction implicit in the grand jury testimony, just as there was here, Mr. Rosen was in effect told that you either speak to the expert, or if you don't speak to the expert, you don't get to put on your defense.
So if I'm tracing your argument right, you're basically saying that when we look for clearly established law, there's a lot of attributes that each case have. You're suggesting, if I'm tracing this correctly, that there's two axes, compulsion and impeachment. And you're saying, actually, the impeachment is a false positive. There's only one axis that matter, compulsion. And so when we look for clearly established law, we should only look for compulsion, and we shouldn't look for the presence of that impeachment prong in clearly established Supreme Court law. Have I traced that back or not?
Well, no, I think the fact of impeachment, I would agree with Your Honor, the fact of the impeachment is of considerably less relevance than the fact of compulsion.
So if there's no Supreme Court law in the impeachment category for this case, second trial, et cetera, that to you is not the variable that matters.
Well, I think there is. I think Portash speaks right to that question. Now, as to whether, I mean, this court in Johnson versus Lamas, even in Wood versus Woodall, the United States Supreme Court said, look, you know, it can be clearly established federal law without, you know, being materially indistinguishable facts. I mean, you can have components components of a claim that are based on fundamental constitutional principles as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court, you can have more than one component. What cases like, and I know you haven't asked me about this, but I think Your Honors, Judge Phipps here, I think your question addresses this kind of, you know, the White v. Woodall conundrum. Like, I mean, are we extending? Are we expanding? And that's not what happened. That is not what is happening here. I mean, this case is leagues closer to this court's case in Washington versus Secretary, where there was a an application of clearly established federal constitutional law, albeit in more than one component, than White v. Woodall, where they were trying to take a constitutional principle or constitutional rule that had been applied at the trial stage, and they were trying to apply it at the sentencing stage. And what Judge Scalia, I believe, held or wrote in his majority opinion was, you're talking about a different proceeding. You're talking about grafting something in a constitutional rule from one type of proceeding onto another type of proceeding. That's not what we're asking for here. What we're asking for here is terribly straightforward. And I'll say in passing that, you know, and this is all over our briefing, I also think that that the seminal case of Estelle v. Smith is virtually on all fours here. I mean, the reason I lead with Buchanan is because there was this whole issue in this appeal about the Commonwealth giving you a document that's not in the record that suggests the defendant was given Miranda warnings, and frankly, I think a lot of that is of little moment. So I thought, you know, I'm not going to talk about the Miranda issue, but that is a second basis. And, you know, this case lines up with Estelle in a very direct way, as in Estelle and as this court said in Gibbs. Here there's no record evidence of warnings even being given. And if assuming they were, there's no sense that the defendant was advised of the circumstances under which his statement could be used. That in fact, the record is devoid of Miranda. At a proceeding where nothing relating to the mental illness defense is raised, that examination is ruled to be admissible. In that way, this case is more on all fours with Estelle than Gibbs was. I mean, I think sometimes when we sort of have to step back, and I think if we do, you know, what we find is in a case where the Pennsylvania Superior Court held that the absence of this, that if this was an erroneous evidentiary ruling, it most certainly would have had to have been prejudicial. And then to deal with that problem, the decision that Your Honors are now having to deal with, which is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision.
The strongest case the case that you relied on the most was Buchanan.
Yes, yeah, I think that's right. Because I think Buchanan is good law without regard to the issue of Miranda. I think it's what Buchanan holds, and what this, and as this court aptly found, is that this kind of evidence is limited to rebuttal of the psychiatric defense.
This is a Jap or Jape?
Jappy.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Adrienne Jaffe on behalf of the Commonwealth in this case. As this court is well aware, state court decision is contrary to clearly established precedents only if it arrives at a conclusion that is opposite to one reached by the United States Supreme Court, not any circuit court, but the United States Supreme Court, on a question of law or fact with materially indistinguishable facts from a relevant Supreme Court case. If this court has to attempt to extend the precedent that is being set forth by the petitioner, then that's not clearly established federal law applicable to this case. The petitioner must demonstrate that the United States Supreme Court precedent requires a contrary outcome to that reached by the state court here. And where the Supreme Court gives no clear answer to the question presented, it cannot be said that the state court unreasonably applied United States Supreme Court precedent. I want to address the cases set forth by the petitioner here. In defendant's brief, he relies primarily on Estelle v. Smith. Today, he's relying, among other cases, including Buchanan versus Kentucky. I would submit that none of them...
Gibbs held that what? The Supreme Court cases clearly established that, well, it only allows a prosecution to use a court-ordered psychiatric interview to provide rebuttal to the psychiatric defense. Is that correct?
Which case are you citing to?
Gibbs.
Gibbs. Well, first of all, Gibbs versus Frank is a Third Circuit case, not a United States Supreme Court case.
I got it.
And in that case, yes, that did say that you can use it for rebuttal. And in that case, it's distinguishable from our case because the evidence there was used in the case in chief. Here, it's being used for rebuttal purposes. And under the law, under the state and federal law, impeachment evidence is, in fact, permitted in these types of cases. So the defendant relies, again, as I said, primarily today on Buchanan. Interestingly, and part of the reason why I did a motion to supplement the appendix was to include the defendant's brief to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, because in that brief, the defendant admits that Buchanan does not discuss the precise issue raised in this case. So therefore, the defendant is conceding that that's not clearly established federal law with respect to this case.
I mean, this is a tough, and it's a nuanced, and it's a close issue. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had a dissent on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, right?
Correct, Your Honor, correct.
So what are you saying that currently is established Supreme Court law, and how does that not apply to this case?
In what case established it?
Yes.
Well, I want to talk about Buchanan first, if I may, because that's the case that I indicated the defendant primarily relies on. In that case, the parties jointly petitioned the court to order a psychiatric examination of the defendant. The defendant raised a mental health defense at trial, and the Commonwealth used the psychiatric report in rebuttal. And as Judge Phipps was questioning petitioner's counsel regarding whether or not Buchanan imposed a limit or whether it was just an example, and I would submit that was just an example of what can or cannot be done. It wasn't limiting the Commonwealth from presenting evidence only in rebuttal of a mental health defense. And the language that I cite to is the, at the very least, language that the court used that Judge Phipps indicated. The court held in that case that the Commonwealth's introduction of a psychiatric report for the limited rebuttal purposes did not constitute a Fifth Amendment violation where the defense asserted the defense placing his mental health in issue. But it did not limit it to that because in so holding, the court noted that this conclusion, and I quote, logically leads to another proposition. If a defendant requests such an evaluation or presents psychiatric evidence, then at the very least, the prosecution may rebut this presentation with evidence from the reports of the examination that the defendant requested. So in using the phrase at the very least in describing what the prosecution may do with the evidence from the psychiatric report, I would submit that the court is leaving open the possibility of the prosecution using this type of evidence as rebuttal evidence when mental health is in fact no longer an issue.
Make it simple for me. When does the waiver of mental status defense in the first trial carry over to the second trial when it's not a defense?
Your Honor, I would submit that this...
Or you can phrase it the opposite. When is the waiver of the defense of mental status carry over when it's not raised in the second trial?
I would submit it carries over in this case because the defendant voluntarily chose to pursue a mental health defense in this case.
In the first trial?
In the first trial. As a result of that, he spoke to the Commonwealth's expert, never asserted any Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. The Commonwealth was permitted to call its experts, and I would submit the defendant can't take back that waiver. It's not a limited waiver. So we can't take it back for the second trial. And the defendant offers no clearly established federal or Supreme Court precedent to the contrary. And the evidence that the Commonwealth did, in fact, seek to introduce...
What relevance in the second trial with a wholly different defense would the testimony in rebuttal or otherwise of Michaels, what would be brought in from Michaels?
It would be general impeachment evidence. And most of the evidence that... Dr. Michaels had from his conversation with the defendant was the same type of evidence that the Commonwealth had from Dr. Fink, the defense expert who also examined the defendant. And the defendant is not raising any challenge here to Dr. Fink's testimony or evidence regarding statements made to Dr. Fink. The defendant is only challenging statements he made to Dr. Michaels.
And so what is the gap that you say, despite all the cases, is not covered by those cases?
The defendant has not put forth any clearly established case law saying the Commonwealth may not use information they obtained from the defendant following his failure to invoke any privilege, any Fifth Amendment waiver privilege. He's not put forth any case law that says the Commonwealth may not use the evidence they received from a defense the defendant voluntarily disclosed in rebuttal evidence second time around.
Okay.
And I do want to address the Gibbs case that the defendant also relies on. I know, Your Honor, Judge McKee, you were, in fact, on the panel in this case. And as I already pointed out, that's not clearly established federal law. With all due respect to Your Honor and the duties of this court, it was a Third Circuit case. And in any event, that case is distinguishable because that case, the Commonwealth put the evidence in the case in chief. In our case, the Commonwealth sought to put the evidence in rebuttal, not the case in chief. And I do want to backtrack a little bit, and I raised this in my brief. While the defendant is, in fact, raising Fifth Amendment claims, and there is, in fact, a Fifth Amendment implication here, quite frankly, this is nothing more than a standard evidentiary matter. So I would submit that initially this claim is not cognizable on federal habeas review.
That I don't understand at all. Could you tell me what you mean by that?
Well, Your Honor, he's simply challenging an in limine ruling, which is quite frankly in the auspices of or the duties of the trial court to rule on the admissibility of the evidence. So I would submit that it's...
But if the in limine ruling is based on Fifth Amendment, doesn't that kind of get us to a constitutional issue? I mean, if it was just an ordinary in limine ruling, like a 403 ruling or something like that, maybe so. But if it implicates constitutional concerns, I mean, you know, it kind of seems weird to say there was an evidentiary ruling. At one level, it was only an evidentiary ruling. But wasn't it animated at least in part by the scope of what the Fifth Amendment protects and doesn't protect?
That's like saying a motion to suppress. A ruling on a motion to suppress, that's just evidentiary. It doesn't implicate the Fourth Amendment.
It does, to an extent, obviously, implicate the Fourth Amendment. However, as it was raised in the trial court, it was part Fifth Amendment and part patient or psychiatrist-patient privilege. So I would submit, in that regard, it's
non-constitutional in that regard.
Correct.
But it doesn't seem that you could reach this ruling without at least some consideration of the bounds of the Fifth Amendment. And that seems to be the thread that you can pull and say it's not just an evidentiary ruling.
And even if this court deems it's not merely an evidentiary ruling because of the Fifth Amendment aspect of it, I would
then
still submit that the defendant can't establish that the state courts did not reasonably apply United States Supreme Court precedent. And I do want to address defendant's claims in his brief regarding the lack of Miranda warnings. And that's part of the reason I submitted my motion to supplement the appendix, and then I believe this court in an order indicated that it would be deemed a motion to supplement the record. So I'd be more than happy to address that. But in terms of the substance, part of the reason why I did that motion to supplement the record was, number one, to bring in the defendant's Supreme Court brief, which wasn't in the actual appendix submitted by petitioner, which basically they established or they aver that Buchanan is not, does not address the precise issue raised here. And then also, I wanted to introduce the report of Dr. Michaels, which is in part an issue here, because there are numerous averments from the petitioner in the brief that there's no evidence of any warnings being given to the petitioner. And in fact, I was in the report that I proffered, which was referred to on the record numerous times by both the prosecution and the defense during the examinations of Dr. Michaels. Dr. Michaels expressly told the defendant at the outset of the interview that he did not have to speak to him, but if he did, anything he said could be used at trial.
Did he say that second part?
The exact language.
He said, I don't want to pretend to have comprehensive knowledge of the record in this case, but I'm not I know that some degree of warning was given. I'm not sure that it said the second part.
Okay, I'll get to that. And by the way, his attorney was with him, and that's on the record in the case, in the transcript, that his attorney was with him during the meeting with Dr. Michaels. He said he informed the petitioner that he had the right to refuse to answer any and all of our questions, that a report would be forwarded to your office, you meaning the prosecutors, and we meaning Dr. Michaels and the other expert that was there, we could be called to testify in this matter. So no, you're correct. He did not say at trial, but we could be called to testify in this matter. And so I'm asking this court to consider that, but to the extent that the defendant is claiming, as he does in his brief, that there is a lack of Miranda warnings, at least according to the record, I would submit that this variant of the claim is waived, it's procedurally defaulted. The first time the defendant ever made reference to any lack of Miranda warnings was in his brief to this court. It was not raised in the state courts. It was not raised in the trial court. And in the district court opinion, the defendant simply took issue with the court allowing the testimony where no mental health defense was at issue. And he averred the statements were compelled without any analysis. He had no discussion whatsoever or any statements about there being given no Miranda warnings. So to the extent that the defendant is now injecting that variant of this claim, I would submit the claim is procedurally defaulted and shouldn't be considered by this court. But if, in fact, this court does consider that variant of the claim, I would ask the court to actually consider my motion to add this report of Dr. Michaels into the record in this case. And I do want to talk about the statements themselves, because I know part in the Certificate of Appealability grant, I know the court indicated for the parties to discuss whether or not the statements were compelled. I would submit that the statements to Dr. Michaels were not, in fact, compelled. And the Fifth Amendment protects an accused from being compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And the Fifth Amendment is not violated unless compelled statements are used against a defendant in a criminal case. Importantly, and as is distinguished in Buchanan, Frank versus Gibbs, and Estelle, the cases cited primarily by the defendant, in every one of those cases, the statements at issue were actually introduced at trial. Here, the purportedly offending statements were never introduced at trial. So that's one of the components of there needing to be a Fifth Amendment violation. The statements need to be introduced against the defendant in a criminal.
So even if a court says they can come in at trial, that's not good enough?
I would submit that's not good enough, Your Honor. And I know the defendant does cite to New Jersey versus Portash in his contention that that's not correct, that even though if the court makes this conditional ruling, that still can, in fact, be a Fifth Amendment violation. I would submit, number one, that case, it was a United States Supreme Court case back from 1979. I guess in the cases I rely on my brief, Chavez versus Martinez, were later cases in the, I think, 2005 was Chavez versus Martinez, which expressly holds in no uncertain terms that the statements must be used against a defendant in trial. So to the extent that that's conflicting with New Jersey versus Portash. I would submit that Chavez versus Martinez controlled. And in any event, Your Honor, the New Jersey versus Portash is also distinguishable because the evidence at issue there was, in fact, compelled testimony. And in that case, when the defendant gave his grand jury testimony, prior to doing so, he was expressly informed by the prosecutor that any statements he said, what he was initially he was going to invoke his Miranda rights, but then there was an agreement amongst his attorney and the prosecutor. And the prosecutor in Portash expressly said that anything you say in this grand jury will not be used against you in a subsequent trial. And in that case, the court made a ruling that, in fact, the statements would be able to be used against the defendant. So they weren't introduced, as in our case, but they were clearly compelled, and there was no evidence to the contrary that they were not, in fact, compelled. So in addition to the statements not being used against the defendant at trial, he never invoked the privilege. So that's another requirement that wasn't met in this case.
And that was covered, in your briefs, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, this was just conditional use of statements, and it was admissible solely for impeachment purposes. And the defendant, what, in my opinion, what he's trying to do here is use the Fifth Amendment as a sword, not a shield. He's trying to insulate himself for perjury. That's not the purpose of the Fifth Amendment here. And I would submit the defendant has forwarded.
Isn't the crux of your argument that there are things that the Supreme Court hasn't decided, and therefore the law is not clearly established?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And unless there's any further questions from the panel, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. Bunch of stuff here.
I guess I'm too anxious. I think there are times when a Supreme Court decision will come down and there's genuine confusion as to what it means. I think clearly this court got it right in Gibbs as to Buchanan. And I'm going to tell you why you can be absolutely certain you got it right. This is the Supreme Court in Cheever.
Can I take notes on this? Tell me why I can know.
I deserve that. Okay. So I take it, and I apologize for the comment. But this is what the court said in Cheever. We have held that testimony based on a court-ordered psychiatric evaluation is admissible only, they didn't emphasize only, but I am, only for a limited rebuttal purpose, citing Buchanan. So you got it right. You were correct. That's what Buchanan says, and you know it's what Buchanan says because that's what Cheever says. And Cheever didn't say, we're extending Buchanan, we're extrapolating for Buchanan. They said, they called it the rule of Buchanan. And the limited purpose, which this court got right, is to rebut a psychiatric defense. It's not about perjury, and the ad hominem aspect of that I will disregard. It's about what the Fifth Amendment means. And it means that you cannot be compelled to be a witness against yourself. And that carve-out is only in the case of the psychiatric expert defense. The other points that my worthy opponent made.
What about Harris?
Harris was a case where the court, Judge Phipps, Harris was a case where the court recognized that we have this prophylactic rule, and this is in the language of the opinion. We have this prophylactic rule. And the rule is there to deter police misconduct. So we need to gauge whether we want to apply that rule to allow a preclusion of the defendant's pretrial hearing testimony. There was no issue of traditional voluntariness. There was no issue of compulsion. It was only a Fifth Amendment issue as far as, is this a prophylaxis that we need to apply to this extent? This case is different. The Commonwealth says that there was no compulsion. Well, that's not what they said before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. They conceded compulsion. That's not what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, correctly, that these statements are compelled. Why are they compelled? Because New Jersey versus Portash tells us that if there is a coercive sanction attendant to the giving of a statement, it's a compelled statement. What did the court in Cheever say? And I know it's post this case, but I'm just trying to make it clear that it's so clear that this kind of statement is compelled. They found that this kind of interview by a commonwealth or a government expert is compelled. What did this court find in Gibbs? Compelled. It's all over the opinion. And it and this court found equivalent what the Texas court required in Estelle v. Smith in that death case and what the Philadelphia Common Pleas Court did in 2000 in the Gibbs case in making the defendant sit for Dr. Sadoff. There was an equivalency. So there's no question about compulsion here. That's the distinction. And it's, you know, the interest is not, you know, the interest is not about the truth-seeking function. The interest is about, in this case, about a defendant's right to remain silent. And the notion that if we're going to abridge that, go ahead, I'm sorry. Yes.
I'm sorry for
having to interrupt. No, please.
But what about, you know, if before we you say this, talk about compulsion, what about the counterpoint that this is procedurally defaulted? You want to talk to that?
Well, I don't think did she argue that the compulsion argument is procedurally defaulted? Well, it's not. I mean, it's argued below. I'm not worried about
okay.
that.
Right.
I don't think the Miranda point is procedurally defaulted either. But the only reason I want to wade into that is I only have 15 minutes, and you know, they filed this motion. I filed the motion. It shouldn't be. I don't want to get sidetracked.
Okay.
But I don't think the compulsion
procedurally
defaulted.
I got confused.
I did want to make one point though, because she my opponent mentioned that alluded to the fact that it wouldn't have made a difference because both experts, because there was no privilege issue in regard to the defense expert. And this actually was the basis of this very unusual prejudice determination by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. It wasn't a classic prejudice determination. The Superior Court made one. They said if there was error in this ruling, the error could not have been harmless because it kept this guy who was going to tell his story off the stand. We had to have found harm. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court took a completely different approach. They said both these experts would have said the same thing, so it would have made a difference because Fink's testimony, the defense expert's testimony, would come in. What difference would it make if Michaels came in? And that is
your brief does cover that.
What's that?
You do cover that point in your brief.
Okay, then I want there's even you know what it's in the record. It's in the record. I missed points that Michaels made that were garden variety impeachment. The three it'll take me 20 seconds. One, that he had sexual problems with his wife. That was going to come out because it would have come out as motive. That she would only have sexual relations if he stopped smoking marijuana. Garden variety impeachment would have gone to motive. That he was unaccustomed to having demands put upon her. That the police made stories to frame him. So all of this garden variety impeachment that only came in because he made this limited waiver, that was going to come in at a retrial. That is a violation of the Fifth Amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Very a fine argument on the part of both counsel. As I said, Mr. Schwartz, I've seen you, not in this context, but trying cases many times. You're as fine an appellate attorney as your trial attorney. Ms. Jaffe, it's a pleasure.
It's nice to see you.
Good seeing you. Take care.